Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us today is Dr. Sandy Magnus, the Deputy Director of Defense Engineering in the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering. She joined the department last year and started her career as an engineer at McDonnell Douglas, working on the Navy's ill-fated A-12 attack plane, but then went on to serve for two decades as a distinguished NASA astronaut with four missions to her credit and 157 days in space, including aboard the 135th and final space shuttle mission in 2011, aboard the shuttle Atlantis, which is now on display at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Center for anybody out there who wants to go see it. She also served for 7 years as the executive director of the American Institute for Aeronautics and Astronautics. Dr. Magnus, it's such an honor having you on.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. I look forward to our conversation.
Very, very much so. And I have to say, I've always been a fan of the Astronaut Corps and the incredible work that they do. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. You did start your career in defense, but spent the bulk of it in the only other government agency that really develops highly complex, high-risk systems to the most stringent specifications, all under enormous cost pressure, the kind of cost pressure that I think DOD sometimes doesn't comprehend in other government departments. So NASA does a lot, but doesn't have a lot of money to do it as a general rule. Coming from that background, what struck you about how DOD does business or even thinks about or thinks through its problems?
Well, you know, the first impression I had coming to the DOD was just the scope and the vastness of the DOD ecosystem. NASA is a smaller agency. It's a tighter ecosystem. I see the culture. NASA's very mission focused, and the people are very mission focused. The DOD, there's a mission, but it's kind of a mission that has sort of stronger little tribal missions embedded in it. So the vibe, if you will, is a little bit different, where, of course, it's all about the national security of the aid of the nation. But yet we have very strong cultural and tribal pieces of that, which Navy, Air Force, Marines and so forth, and so an Army. So I really sense that. And so how the business of the organization happens has that tribal lens a little bit more, where at NASA, it's like big mission writ large, exploring space, whether that's with humans or robotics. I also have noticed that perhaps it's a size issue as well. And admittedly, I haven't been out in the DOD everywhere yet, but there's a very strong systems engineering technical workforce at NASA that I see not so much at the DOD. And I think it's something that we need to reinvigorate. And that's something that my organization is really very much focused on, how we can build, rebuild, or strengthen and invigorate the systems engineering practices here in the DOD.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned, that unity of effort is critical. And DOD makes progress and develops incredible systems, but sometimes with a lack of focus, as you said, right? There's tribalism. Each of the services are kind of doing their own thing in their own way for their own reasons. They cooperate sometimes when forced at gunpoint to do so. Where and how can DOD improve? And what can it learn from the kind of focus that maybe NASA has or learn from whatever source, right? I mean, at the end of the day, you're in the business of developing complex systems and fielding them at scale and at speed. How and where can DOD improve?
Well, I think, again, okay, I have a year in to the here at the Pentagon, but what I've observed is that because our focus is shifting to near peer and peer adversaries, that there's a recognition that there has to be a lot more thinking along joint and interoperability and strategic. And so there are sort of a coalition of the willing around the urgency that that's creating these drives to be a little bit more strategic in our thinking. There's a big push to do what's called mission engineering, which is really systems of systems engineering in the context of, hey, you know, as we think about the capabilities that we should be investing in, let's, you know, do that from the top down instead of thinking, oh, I want a shiny new toy, then let's see how we can use it. Let's think about what capabilities we, no kidding, need to be building across the whole construct of our ecosystem. And let's put some analytical rigor behind that. And let's try and strategically drive that a little bit more from the top. And that can happen if everybody at the top is on the same page, even in a you know, pseudo tribal system. So I see movement in that direction, driven from both the Joint Chiefs from the OSD, you know, the Secretary's office, as well as a recognition, you know, a further down in sort of the tribes, if you will, that this is required. So I see that trend happening, which I think is really great, even though structurally we're not set up to do that naturally, if you will.
What are some of the other things? You know, there's this sense that people have of astronauts that they're constantly rehearsing or preparing for a mission, as opposed to, yes, you're doing that, but also you have a whole series of actually important engineering jobs in the ecosystem of the organization that you're always pursuing, whether it's on the scientific side for some people or the actual engineering side for other folks. What are some of the key lessons you've learned throughout your career? Because I think AIAA is also an extraordinary, truly extraordinary organization. I mean, it's sort of like one of these jewels the nation has that people don't tend to think about as much either, where you had an enormous amount of experience understanding the state of the technological art, for example, across the piece. What are the elements that you've picked up over your career that you think are most applicable to your current job, and maybe lessons that are worth sharing more widely across the R&E enterprise?
Well, that's a great question. And to your point, yeah, there's a lot of time when we're in the astronaut office where we are definitely not flying or training, and we're doing sort of engineering jobs. And I think the big thing that I've picked up there is I was an operator in, you know, my astronaut job. I was an operator, but I'm also by training a scientist and an engineer. And so having the ability to merge those three lenses, if you will, is really valuable. And in the astronaut office, we were working with scientists to figure out how to help them design payloads and science experiments in space, understanding, you know, what the operational environment was. We were working with the people who are developing tools for spacewalks, how to design the tools so we can use them. So I think what I bring to this job, or what I think is very valuable, is to have those three lenses. So as an engineer, and we're trying to figure out how to create systems, I can look at that through an operator lens in the context of what's important to the operator. And we all recognize, and of course, the commercial industry also recognizes, that the user's experience or the user interface with technology or equipment is really important. And how are these things going to be used? And one of the things that I focused on too here is the safety aspect. You know, are we thinking about the safety aspect of the things that we're building from the operator's viewpoint? And then I think from AIAA, it's interesting. A lot of the things that I've learned running AIAA are very useful in the department, because at AIAA, it's a volunteer organization. It's a wonderful organization. It's, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's all the scientists and technologists and engineers who work across the aerospace industry writ large. And they're a very passionate group of people, and they put a lot of time into the organization to make it as successful as it is. So it's primarily a volunteer organization. But how you manage and lead volunteers is different than how you might manage and lead a staff. So here in the DoD, when you consider that, because of the structure of the organization, typically you're leading coalitions of the willing, right? Similar kind of dynamic. You have to encourage people to participate because they see that, A, it's in their best interest, and two, they're contributing to a bigger cause, and three, there's a path to see that we can actually accomplish something. And so that's a valuable leadership skill for this department especially.
In this, I want to get in a little bit of the mechanics and the technology with you. In this great power competition, strategists see advantage as fleeting, right? something that's no longer measured in years, but actually days, hours, and perhaps minutes, and some have even postulated seconds. We've been talking about the need for innovation and for speed for years. You're a key leader in the enterprise. You just reorganized your office. What are the keys to speed, and how are you driving the organization to move just not only faster, but smarter? Because there's this concern that's lingering that every time DoD has moved, or at least in recent memory, fast, it's also ended up moving wrong, right? So how are you driving this process faster, but also smarter?
Yeah, it's a conundrum, right? That there's a need to go fast. First of all, it's a huge monstrous organization, so there's huge amounts of inertia there, right? Plus, it's wrapped around with laws and requirements from Congress and the taxpayers of how we have to do certain things. And there are good reasons for that. You know, you need to have competition. You need to make sure you're not abusing taxpayer trust with the way we're spending funds, which requires a certain amount of oversight. And so there's definitely some boundaries that we have to play in. But inside those boundaries, we do have to think about how to move fast because, you know, people that we're competing, adversaries that we're competing against don't have some of these constraints and they're moving quickly as well. And so you see a lot of experiments. You know, I'll get to my organization in a minute, but you see a lot of experiments across the DoD of how to make sure we're meeting the needs of our customer base, the Congress and the taxpayer, but yet trying to experiment. And so, you know, the middle tier rapid acquisition process, the MTA process is one of those experiments. Some of these rapid capabilities offices that you've seen popped up is experiments. And inside my organization, we're not a large organization, so what we're really trying to do is form these alliances and these coalitions that I mentioned, is reach out and figure out where the pockets of innovation are going on and make sure that we're propagating those practices across the department. There's a lot of reinventing the wheel that goes on in an organization this size, right? Because the left hand and the right hand don't even know they're connected to the same body sometimes, let alone what they're doing. And so one of the things we're trying to do is ensure we're not doing anything to reinvent the wheel. And if there's somebody out there doing a great thing, you know, a good engineering methodology, or they have best practices and lessons learned, how can we propagate that quickly across the ecosystem? And that lets us be both smarter and faster. And it's that series of connections and that series of relationships and those series of communities is what we're trying to build so that we can be on a quicker learning curve, if you will.
Let me get into the technologies really quickly. About what technologies you think are the most important and intriguing, coming from sort of the wide understanding you're bringing to the job? I've asked a similar sort of question with some of your other colleagues as well, whether Jim Faced or with Mark Lewis. What do you think are the most important technologies for the United States and its allies to maintain advantage? And then I'll ask you about what our adversaries are doing that sort of keep you awake at night. But let's start with what are the most important things we should be focusing on, with perhaps a little bit more urgency than we're focused on them?
So let me start big and then get narrow, right? So if you look at what R&E, the research and engineering group here is doing, we've identified several modernization areas. That's a span of technologies that when Mike Griffin actually set up the org that were recognized as being really important and urgent for us to focus on as a nation. And, you know, you can read down the list if you go to the website. It's hypersonics, autonomy, machine learning, AI, fully network command and control, you know, biology, microelectronics and so forth. You can go through the list. And then as you ask individual people questions, everyone has their favorite technology. But I think observing the department for the last year and understanding what's going on in the outside world in general, just with how society is evolving and technology is evolving, even in the commercial world, I think it's really all about information and understanding how to collect information and move information from point A to point B, digest the information, and filter through the noise. Because you can go to the internet, for example, and you can get a lot of data, but understanding what it really means and getting to a quick solution or a decision that you can act on. And so it's, you know, collecting, gathering, assimilating, digesting, and acting on information. I think that's really a key strategic advantage that, and that manifests itself in a bunch of different technologies, right? But I think that's really a key. Let's call it an attribute as opposed to a technology that is important.
America, it's interesting you say that because, right, I mean, that's at the very core of what each of us do, right? We're all information organizations. We just use information differently. And getting people to understand, you know, they think about the United States Army or the Navy or a motion picture company or what we do. We're just all in information. It's just how we manage to use information at the end of the day. So, you know, that's encouraging. And I think that's why America's adversaries are working along a lot of these same lines, right? We've heard Vladimir Putin talk about data as being the new oil. We have the Chinese, right? I mean, if you look at it, their entire culture is almost engineered as a large data collection platform, right? There's a whole bunch of reasons why we want everybody on WeChat. It's very convenient, but I'm also collecting on you from everything. Currency is no longer accepted. You do your transactions through WeChat. I can then see whether, you know, what you're up to, for example, which are also great advantages those systems have in an AI kind of construct, given that a lot of our data is, you know, unfortunately in paper form and we can't really use it as much. What, given our adversaries, we now all have the same technology roughly. What are the things that America's adversaries are doing and developing that keep you awake at night and should inspire somewhat greater urgency on our end? I mean, for example, undersea was someplace that we dominated. We were the only people who could get to the deepest parts of the ocean on a fairly regular basis. But now Russia, for example, is militarizing the unmanned vehicle it sent to the Challenger Deep, the deepest point of the ocean. And we can understand that there are a variety of reasons that Russia would want to do that. And China's not far behind on some of this. How do you assess where we are and what should really worry us and drive us to maybe move a little bit more quickly and with more focus than perhaps we have been?
Well, you know what I think worries me the most is not so much what our adversaries are doing per se, as the fact that we, you know, our system has a very short, you know, our governance system, our ability to do long-term strategic thinking, and this is a problem we have in the space industry, long-term plan, stick to the plan, execute the plan, and a very mindful, you know, plotting from step one to step two kind of a way. That's, you know, we're at a disadvantage there, right? Because our near-peer adversaries are able to plan over decades and decades and execute that over decades and decades. We have a shorter attention span, and that can work to our advantage, right? Because it allows us to be very innovative and we can turn on a dime. And that's a strong component of our culture because we have such a diverse culture. But on the other hand, it, you know, not having kind of a longer term view and sticking to a longer term view and being able to execute a longer term view can be a disadvantage for us. I think, you know, if I worry about anything, that's really where I worry, you know, that lack of attention span, if you will, for the long term.
Right. If speed is about focus, leadership focus, right, these are the things we want to accomplish, delegating them to highly qualified people. The challenge is, or has been repeatedly explained, is that we have great people, but not enough of them who are both technically savvy, but also great program managers, especially at a time when we're trying to move so much stuff so quickly through the pipeline. And that's manifest whether you're on the government side, but also you hear contractors talk about that all the time. In fact, there are mishaps that are attributed to, well, you know, we're not as strong on the engineering as we should have been, for example. How is the department and how are you working to address, I mean, A, is that the problem? And if that's the problem, what are we doing to fix the problem? Because unfortunately, the very skills that you need take a long time to grow, don't they?
Yeah, you know, this goes back to the conversation that we've been having as a country ever since, you know, I was a young engineer, about STEM and the importance of STEM education, the importance of getting young people engaged in the STEM pipelines, and we don't do a good job of it. I think we could do better. And you look at China, for example. They have such a huge population that they, even though they may have a lower, and I don't know the statistics, so don't quote me, but even if they have statistically a lower proportion, they still have a greater number of people. And the importance of a STEM education is it helps you. I think when I talked to young engineers, when I was at AIAA, I was talking to students, like the superpower that you have as an engineer, for example, is really your ability to take a complex problem and break it down into piece parts and solve it, right? And that's a critical thinking skill set. And this happens to be in a technical base, of course, that we need everywhere. And so technical literacy in the country is just bad. And even if people aren't going into STEM, having some exposure to that as a matter of course as they go through their normal educational process is really super important. And we just don't do a good job of that. And I will tell you right now, I've seen over the last year in the DoD, we have a really severe shortage of people who can work in the software realm across all facets of that. And so for any of you out there who are listening and want to have job security, encourage your students and your young people that you know to go into software and how to do various aspects of that. But I think we really could do better. And there are, you know, I've been involved in STEM activities my whole career and encouraging young people to follow these paths. And there are a lot of activities going around the country in this area. So there's no shortage of energy around it. But I think it's eluded us yet how to really fully engage the young population with the excitement of these types of careers, unfortunately.
Well, as somebody who is inspired by the Apollo generation, right, Apollo 8 is my earliest memory. You know, I remember Apollo 11, watched the space shuttle program, you know, throughout its span. There are so many programs to try to do this. In fact, one of your other important jobs as an astronaut was to be that ambassador, you know, go to schools, get kids excited about stuff like this. And at the end of the day, you know, I find a lot of very successful engineer friends of mine, even who've achieved PhDs, frankly, end up on Wall Street, right? Because they can make more money on Wall Street than they can in an academic career. After Sputnik, we had a national program to generate engineers and scientists. And that paid decades-long dividends for us, right? I mean, whether it was for putting a man on the moon or developing communications, computing, internet, and beyond. I mean, that was sort of the generation that did that. Do we need another sort of focused effort that, you know, sort of, you know, frankly, more lionizes the scientists and the engineers as opposed to sort of regarding them as sort of necessary dorks, for lack of a better word. I mean, I don't want to put this in too nasty a way, but actually makes it really cool. I think Big Bang Theory helped on that, right? I think more people said they wanted to be theoretical physicists than probably at any other point in history, short of the 1920s. Right. You know, how, right. Because Einstein was a rock star, right? So
yeah.
How do we think about this?
Yeah, there's several elements there. Number one, I will certainly never turn down a focused, well thought out and decently executed national program. But two, so that's kind of a push, right? But you need a pull. I think, you know, I wasn't around it. I was five when Apollo happened. But I think what happened there is people were inspired. And China, of course, is using their space program totally for this purpose, right? You see these great, inspirational, huge, monstrous achievements, and everybody wants to be a part of that. That's positive. That's hopeful. That's inspiring. And it's like, wow, that's so cool. I want to be a part of that. I'm going to go be an engineer. I want to do that thing, right? And so having those kind of inspirational projects, if you will, that we applaud and we highlight, and that's a pull for students and young people to want to be a part of, you know, a STEM ecosystem. So thinking about that. And number two, we don't do a good job of even explaining engineering. So for example, when I was in middle school and I decided I wanted to be an astronaut, and that was like, hey, I want to go do that, I didn't know engineering existed as a discipline. I focused on physics, which was my first degree, and I had this path in my head that I was going to go all the way through PhD, get a, you know, in physics, and then apply. And then I got to college and I discovered engineering, and I'm like, oh, wow, this is really cool. I want to learn more about this. So as a seventh or eighth grader trying to decide what I wanted to do with my life to be an astronaut, I couldn't pick engineering because I didn't know what it was and I didn't know what engineers do. And I suspect, actually I don't suspect, I know this is part of our problem. When I talk to, you know, teenage girls or middle school students or whoever, if you haven't been exposed to an engineer because you don't have one in your family, you might not even know what an engineer does. So how can you pick that as a career, right? And I think that's just so sad.
right, there weren't many women astronauts. So, you know what I mean? So it's also very hard to sort of see role models in the group that you're looking at of, you know, middle-aged white military guys, right? I mean, and Harrison Schmitt, right?
I mean, and role models, by the way, role models are huge, right? I was I went to high school in 1978. That was my freshman year. And they had the big newspaper article about the first women selected in the astronaut program. And I remember breaking down in tears because I'm like, oh my gosh, there's a path for me now. I can see it. And so when I talked to, when I was out and about in the aerospace community, what I'd like to remind people, and so for your listeners, it's like everybody who's listening to you, us on this podcast, are role models in some way, shape, or form. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, an older white male or a young African-American female or someone with two heads and purple hair. You are a role model to somebody somewhere, and you need to reach out and do that. So, for example, when I came back from my first mission, I spoke to probably 80% of the students in my hometown. It's a medium-sized town, because for them, I'm from there, right? So it meant something, whether they're male or female, it meant something to them that I was from that area and I did something unusual. And so all of a sudden, maybe they could see themselves. So I think all of us in the STEM fields have to be very aware that we are role models and get out and talk to young people. And share what you do, and share, people in the STEM fields, we're very passionate about what we do. And if we get out there and share that passion, you know, even if you only talk to one school classroom a year, you know, there's millions of us. If we all do that, that starts to make a difference, right? And you never know, when you have a casual conversation with a young person and you're sharing something you're passionate about, you never know where you can touch them and actually inspire them to go do something. And so it's worth a little bit of effort on everybody's part to share their experiences and be that role model for some unknown young person that you're going to influence and not have a knowledge that you did so.
Completely. And that's very, very inspirational. And I think that's the right way to be looking at it. Although I will say that if you can do what we did in the 1950s, which is also, you know, make scholarships available and tax breaks available to sort of say, hey, society needs you to do this, I think that would also be something that would likely also attract people. Let me ask you, I can't let you go as a giant space fan who admires your service over decades for what you're doing and have done for the nation. What's your favorite space story or anecdote that you think, you know, that you like to share with people?
Oh my gosh, there's so many, but I will tell you, on my last mission, the cupola was not attached to the space station before, when I was living there in 2008, 2009, it came up later. And so for those of you who aren't aware, the cupola is no kidding, this little room with windows all the way around. So you can see the Earth in a 360 degree view, and the sort of the ceiling, if you will, of the cupola is also glass, so you can look down on the Earth because it's at the bottom of the station, so it actually looks down on the Earth. And so on STS-135, you know, when everybody went to bed, I would go to the cupola it takes us 90 minutes to go around the Earth. So for three or four nights in a row, I'd go over to the cupola and I would just spend, you know, one revolution of the Earth just floating in the cupola with the Earth surrounding me, kind of watching a revolution as we went, you know, from sun to behind the Earth and the dark side. And it was just so peaceful and so beautiful just to watch the Earth go by and have it all to myself. And it was all quiet on the space station. And I was kind of like the only person in the universe at that moment, is what it felt like. And it was just really awesome. We have such a beautiful planet. It's so amazing.
It's probably worth taking care of it, right? Because the notion that we're going to get anywhere else as quickly as we'd like, probably not very operative, right?
Yeah. If I can share one more story with you, I think we take things for granted when they're in their backyard. So those of us in DC, you don't think about the fact that we have all these free museums that are available, and that's really unique in the world because it's normal. We've normalized to it, right? And so we've done the same with the Earth. And, you know, you don't know anything different. So people take the Earth for granted. You take the fact that you can go outside and breathe fresh air for granted. The fact that you can go hiking in the mountains and be around all these beautiful trees for granted. The fact that we have oceans of water just sloshing around the planet, you know, and they're beautiful. You take that for granted. And so when you leave the Earth, just like if you leave your home and you go to a different place, you realize there's things about your home that you took for granted. You know, you leave the Earth and you look down on it and you get a completely different view and you realize, wow, we can't take this planet for granted. right? It's a spaceship, right. And it's a closed system. And it was really fun to come back after my 4.5 month mission, and the hatch opened to the shuttle, and we were in Florida. So this kind of ocean, salty, you know, earthy breeze blew into the hatch when they opened it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's fresh air. You know, that's a fresh breath of fresh air. And the guys who had only been up there for like 10 days, cause they came to get me and bring me home, they looked at me like I was crazy. Cause to them, they had just been gone 10 days and it was no big deal, but I hadn't had a breath of fresh air, you know, feeling the wind on my face for 4.5 months. And it was really pleasurable. So, you know, don't take it for granted.
Right. I mean, 1968, it was Earthrise, Bill Anders's picture on Apollo 8 that really sparked for many people the gravity of the situation. And I think, you know, as you said, most people don't recognize that it's microscopic bacteria in the ocean on which all of us depend for the oxygen that we breathe. Right. Yeah. So at the end of the day, everything is really interconnected. Dr. Magnus, thanks so much for spending so much time with us. I really, really appreciate it and look forward to having you back on again.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.